Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're already a member of this weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, a witch ends up in court, not as the defendant, but as the plaintiff. As you may have heard, nothing sells like sex and death. A Louisville brothel combined the two when someone dropped dead from poisoning, and the media absolutely loved it. While out jogging, Sherry Papini inexplicably disappeared. 22 days later, she returned home with a story so incredible it was hard to believe. In fact, some people still don't believe her after all these years. And when groups of sinister drones began hovering over homes in America's Midwest, the FBI, the U.S. Air Force, and 16 police forces set up a task force. But then the drones vanished. And some wonder if the drones ever existed at all. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. Sideville is a quaint farming village in Normandy, France, near the only slightly larger town of Yerville, part of the Siena Inferior region, 35 miles from Havre and 80 miles northwest of Paris. Sideville's always been a sleepy little hamlet, but in the winter of 1851, it was at the center of a curious defamation trial involving accusations of sorcery and the predations of an inconsiderate yet musically talented poltergeist. This was a rare instance where the accused witch was the plaintiff and the priest was the defendant, and ultimately everything got blamed on an angry ghost. Father Jean Tinnell was the curé of Sideville, a parish priest entrusted with the souls of the good people of the town, and sadly, beginning in November 1850, he found his parsonage beset by a disturbance of inexplicable character centering on two young pupils in his household, Gustave Lemonnier, age 12, and Bunel, age 14. Gustave and Bunel were known to be of amiable dispositions, the sons of respectable parents who had entrusted Tinnell with preparing the youths for entry into the priesthood. Beginning in late November 1850, usually in whatever room the boys were in, strange rapping sounds were heard and objects flew about of their own accord. Gustave Lemonnier, the younger of the pupils, age 12, said that raps began when he was alone on November 26th and continued. He saw knives, blacking brushes, a roasting spit, and M. Tinnell's breviary leave their places and go through the window panes. All sorts of objects flew about. He was struck in the face by a shoe, a candlestick, and by a black hand which afterward disappeared up the chimney. A sort of human shape, dressed in a blouse which appeared to be a specter, followed him for a whole fortnight. We learn from other witnesses that the child said that this specter was only 15 inches high. Once an invisible force pulled him by the leg, his comrade sprinkled some holy water and the force let go. Then a child's voice was heard crying, "Pardon, mercy!" Notwithstanding all these disquieting events, he did not ask to be allowed to go home. Obviously, such spectral shenanigans were a bit disconcerting, but young Gustave and Bunel were priests in training, so it seems like they recognized that one of the job requirements was doing battle with evil spirits. Now, poltergeists have been known to land people in the loony bin or hospital, but rarely do they wind up in a courtroom. Legal trouble started when Gustave reported that the phantom in the blouse bore a remarkable resemblance to a shepherd swain, swain being a generic term for a country youth, which is a little bit odd since Thorell was aged 40 at the time, from a nearby town named Felix Thorell, to whom Tinnell had introduced the boys. Bunel reported that his compatriot Gustave had a nervous attack and lost consciousness immediately after meeting Thorell, making the apparent similarity of the apparition even more suspicious. To make matters worse, rumors had it that Thorell had boasted of his powers as a sorcerer. This was enough to convince Father Tinnell that something was awry at the Circle K. he accused Thorell of producing the bizarre phenomena in his parsonage and tormenting his two pupils. By Tennell's account, Thorell promptly knelt and begged his and the boy's pardon, but Tennell was not feeling particularly charitable. Priests don't dig the sorcery thing. Tennell demanded that Thorell's employer, unsurprisingly named Mr. Payne, dismiss the shepherd. Not entirely satisfied that Thorell had been thoroughly reprimanded, Tennell beat him with a stick to the effusion of blood. Poor Thorell was now accused of sorcerous nefariousness, bloody, and unemployed. This was mid-19th century France, so they weren't burning witches anymore, and the occasional beating of the underclass was nothing to write home about. What you really didn't want was to be unemployed and indigent in Normandy. Thereupon, Thorell, having lost his place as shepherd in consequence of such suspicions, brought suit for defamation of character against the curate, laying the damages at 1,200 francs. The trial was commenced before the Justice of the Peace of Urville on the 7th of January, 1851. And it was at this trial that the bizarre details of the poltergeist's behavior were described and written down for all posterity in the records of the court, including a parade of notable and respected witnesses to the strange goings-on in the Tennell household. Tennell and his students were deposed, outlining the character of the poltergeist activity after the initial rappings. Quote, "On Tuesday, the 26th of November, 1850, as the two children were at work in one of the rooms in the upper story of the parsonage, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they heard knockings, resembling light blows of a hammer on the wainscoting of the apartment. These knockings were continued daily throughout the week, at the same hour of the afternoon. On the next Sunday, the 1st of December, the blows commenced at midday, and it was on that day that the curate first thought of addressing them. He said, 'Strike louder!' Thereupon, the blows were repeated more loudly. They continued thus all that day. On Monday, December 2nd, the elder of the two boys said to the knockings, 'Beat time to the tune of Maître Corbeau,' and they immediately obeyed. The next day, Tuesday, December 3rd, the boy having related the above circumstance to M. Tennell, he, Tennell, being much astonished, resolved to try and said, 'Play us Maître Corbeau,' and the knockings obeyed. The afternoon of that day, the knockings became so loud and violent that a table in the apartment moved somewhat, and the noise was so great that one could hardly stay in the room. Later in the same afternoon, the table moved from its place three times. The curate's sister, after assuring herself that the children had not moved it, replaced it, but twice it followed her back again. The noises continued with violence all that week." Unquote. Owen, 1860, page 272. It's rare to find a poltergeist that'll take requests from your playlist, and if it wasn't for the various ghostly assaults that followed, it might have just been an intriguing novelty. Alas, poltergeists are temperamental little critters, and the earnestness with which it made its presence known escalated. Witnesses emerged to attest to the ensuing nastiness that plagued Father Tennell's humble home. A.M. de Becknell testified to hearing particularly requested tunes beaten by the rappings, and that he could in no way discern the origin. Another local notable named August Hewitt, a neighboring proprietor, along with the curate of Limsey and another gentleman, heard similar rappings and were convinced the young boys could not have produced the sounds themselves. The poltergeist obligingly beat time to the tune of Au Clair de la Lune upon request. The mayor of Sideville reported he watched as a set of fireplace tongs and a shovel flew across the room. The curate of Saussay testified that upon visiting Tennell's parsonage, he saw hammers and bread move by themselves in manners he could not explain, emphasizing that in regards to the veracity of his testimony, that he would sign it with his own blood. A local aristocrat, the Marquis de Merville, having heard of the disturbances, resolved to investigate them. Initially, he heard scratchings and rappings, but, undaunted, he resolved to experiment and described his experience to the court. The transcripts of the testimony of the Marquis de Merville outline his findings. Quote, "Last Wednesday, I went to the presbytery of Sideville and said to the cause, 'When you wish to reply affirmatively, rap once. When you wish to reply negatively, rap twice.' Immediately, a rap was heard. 'Then you'll be able to tell me how many letters there are in my name.' 8 raps were heard, the last more distinct than the others, apparently to make one understand that it was the last. 'My baptismal name now?' Reply, 5 raps. 'And now my forename, which figures on the register of the civil list and which no one has hitherto called me by.' Immediately, 7 raps. 'And the names of my children, first the eldest, 5 raps. Quite correct, she is called Aline. That of the youngest, 9 raps. A mistake immediately rectified, for 7 raps were struck. She's called Blanche. Now let us pass to my age. Strike as many raps as I have years.' Instantly, the raps succeeded each other with such rapidity that I was obliged to stop them in order to count them, and I demanded more slowness. 48 raps were then heard very distinctly, the 48th being more accentuated than the others. That's not all. How many months do you reckon between the 1st of January of this year and the moment I shall be 49? Three very loud raps and one faint one followed. What does the faint one mean? Probably half a month? One rap. Good, but it is not finished. How many days now between that half month and my birthday? Nine raps, the last being more accentuated. Perfectly correct. I shall be 49 on the 24th of April of this year. Let us pass on to the place of my abode. How many letters are there in its name? Eight raps. And in the name of my commune, be careful not to make the usual mistake. 10 raps were heard. Now I live in the commune of Gomerville, the name of which is often written with two M's, a mistake not made by the cause. It was demonstrated to me by this that I had to do with an old acquaintance, I hope not a friend. Let us pass to music. You are said to be a musician. The other day, you sang the first part of Rossini's Stabat, they say. Since you know the first paragraph, you ought to know the second part, the bass part. Let me hear it. Instantly, the mysterious agent slapped the rhythm of the first two bars correctly enough, but in the third committed an irregularity which slightly spoiled the rhythm. On my remarking this, it began again, corrected the mistake, and the passage was recognizable. Two or three more popular airs were articulated rapidly and without any mistake. The other pieces from the Italian repertoire which I demanded were perfectly and known to it. Come, I said to it, you are a poor dilettante. Now follow me if you can. I then hummed a waltz from the Guillermo Tell. It listened at first, without doing anything, then followed me exactly while I sang it, and several times during the morning, when we were no longer thinking of it, it came back to the same piece and tried to execute it alone. Unquote. Lang, 1904, pages 458 and 459. Personally, I think the Marquis' expectation for the musical acumen of a dead guy were overly optimistic, and frankly, were I a specter, I would probably have thrown something at him for his snarky commentary. But one can only expect the merest modicum of social restraint from a 19th-century French aristocrat. They were just getting over the revolution, after all. Over a dozen additional witnesses were called and swore to either experiencing the musical machinations of the poltergeist, objects inexplicably flying about the parsonage, or Tennell's angry encounter with Felix Thorl. Finally, judgment was rendered on February 15, 1851, the learned judge concluding that the extraordinary phenomena at the Presbytery of Sideville remain unknown. This is, of course, a rather irritating official judgment and didn't really help Thorl, as Thorl himself had reportedly taken credit for sorcerous activities that caused the poltergeist activity at Tennell's parsonage, as well as showing contrition before witnesses on two occasions. The court concluded that the defamation suit was frivolous. Thorl was ordered to pay 6 francs in court costs and sent packing. Meanwhile, there was still a poltergeist to deal with. Tennell's superiors in the church ordered the two young students to be removed and situated with another teacher, and immediately the poltergeist activity in the Tennell parsonage ceased. There are a few lessons here. First, don't sue for libel when you've gone around singing your own praises as a powerful sorcerer. Even if you're not responsible for local occult activity, you'll probably be blamed for it. Second, music does seem to soothe the savage beast, and unfortunately, few people have tried the musical approach of communicating with a poltergeist. Third, poltergeist activity always spirals into throwing stuff, or getting sucked into a television, or some such unsavory end. Sure, maybe it's entertainment at first, but inevitably dealing with the angry spirits involves projectiles. I'm sure there's some sort of obscure fourth lesson about not being a peasant in Normandy. There's also a lesson here for poltergeists as well, and it comes from Aristotle, who said, "Anybody can become angry, that's easy, but to be angry with the right person, and to the right degree, and at the right time, and for the right purpose, and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power, and is not easy." Evidently, we don't get any better at it when we're dead. When Weird Darkness returns, you may have heard nothing sells like sex. Of course, for weirdos listening to this podcast, nothing sells like death. Well then, a Louisville brothel combined the two when somebody dropped dead there from poisoning, and the media absolutely loved it. From the time the concept of mass media was invented, it's been universally acknowledged that nothing sells like sex and death. Put the two together, and you've got a surefire public favorite. So naturally, when people started dropping dead in a Louisville brothel, local journalists thought they themselves had died and gone straight to heaven. The establishment run by 40-year-old Emma Austin spent the night of September 8, 1892 in a quiet manner, or at least as quiet as it is in such places as brothels. Besides Mrs. Austin, the occupants were her 11-year-old son Lloyd, Austin's laundress, Rachel Jackson, Mrs. Jackson's younger daughter, Lily, and Austin's star employee, young, beautiful Eugenia Sherrill. Some four or five men came to call. Mrs. Sherrill, before presumably entertaining visitors in more private fashion, played Nearer My God to Thee on the piano. Someone sent out for ice cream, which was enjoyed by everyone in the house, and so to bed. The next morning, young Lloyd said that he was not feeling well, but Mrs. Austin insisted he go to school anyway. She then made breakfast, batter cakes, cantaloupe, jam, and coffee. Mrs. Austin and Eugenia Sherrill were the only ones to partake of the meal. The other residents would soon be thankful they had skipped breakfast. Almost immediately, the two women began feeling deathly ill, suffering from uncontrollable vomiting and diarrhea. Mrs. Johnson, who was temporarily boarding in the house, heard their cries of agony and summoned a doctor. As a side note, reporters later had a lot of fun publishing Mrs. Johnson's insistent remarks that she had no idea, no sir, no suspicion in the world, that she was rooming in a house of ill repute. At first, the physician, Dr. Brennan, presumed the women were suffering from nothing worse than a case of severe food poisoning, an ailment sadly common in pre-refrigeration summers, and gave them the medicine appropriate for such cases. However, Austin and Sherrill continued to deteriorate. Their eyes dilated, they were covered in a cold sweat, and most alarmingly of all, they had begun vomiting blood. The doctor soon realized the women had been poisoned, probably deliberately. This shocking development opened up an embarrassing can of worms for everyone involved. As I said earlier, Mrs. Johnson was left trying to explain why she, a seemingly respectable lady, had spent the last 2 weeks living in a brothel. Eugenia Sherrill's position was even more mortifying. Prostitution was merely her secret side career. Up until now, she was known to society only as a member of one of Kentucky's most prominent and respectable families. Even worse, for the past year, she'd been married to Edward Sherrill, a prosperous traveling salesman. In her agony, poor Mrs. Sherrill was frantic to be brought to her home so she could die without her double life being discovered. Unfortunately, she was far too ill to be moved. Dr. Brennan was helpless to save them. Eugenia died at 12:45 p.m. Mrs. Austin's sufferings ended 2 hours later. As it was obvious that foul play had taken place, the coroner immediately arranged an inquest. To save time, it was held in the brothel, which may be some sort of true crime first. Because little Lloyd Austin was sick after eating the ice cream the night before, it was at first suspected that the dessert might have been poisoned. However, this theory was dismissed when it was realized that no one else felt ill after eating the ice cream. Most likely, the boy had just consumed so much of it that he gave himself indigestion. Among the inquest witnesses was Mrs. Austin's adult daughter, Nellie Cook. Mrs. Cook lived elsewhere, having, as she enigmatically put it, left my mother's house several weeks ago. When she heard of her mother's illness, she came to see her. She testified that Mrs. Austin told her that she and Mrs. Sherrill became sick right after eating breakfast. Mrs. Cook also revealed that she'd done a fine job of eliminating evidence by throwing away all the remnants of the batter cakes. None of the other witnesses were able to contribute anything useful to the investigation. An autopsy was performed on Mrs. Austin. Since Mrs. Sherrill had obviously died of the same cause, it was evidently felt that it was unnecessary to perform a post-mortem on her as well. It was revealed that Mrs. Austin had died from ingesting some irritant poison, possibly arsenic. As no such substance was kept in the house, this indicated deliberate poisoning. Considering that the two dead women were the only ones to eat the batter cakes, that meal was clearly what had been adulterated. Meanwhile, Edward Sherrill returned to Louisville from a business trip to be greeted by the shock of his life. It's hard to know what stunned him most, the news that his young bride had been poisoned, or the revelation that whenever he was out of town, Eugenia was spending her nights in a brothel. The despairing man dashed to Mrs. Austin's house, where the bodies of the two victims were on macabre public display, and clasped his wife's body in his arms, wailing piteously that he refused to believe the vile stories about her. It was some 15 minutes before the hysterical Mr. Sherrill could be parted from the corpse, still crying and insisting that his beloved Jeannie had been true to him. It must have been a heart-rending thing to watch. And of course, every detail was lovingly preserved in the newspapers. Mrs. Austin was quietly buried in Cave Hill Cemetery. In contrast, Eugenia's funeral in her native Meade County was one of the largest in the area's history. Hundreds attended her burial, all of them apparently drawn by an odd combination of pity and salacious curiosity. There was no question that the two women had been deliberately poisoned, but no one could agree on who did it and why. Nellie Cook suggested that Emma deliberately poisoned her food and, for some unfathomable reason, decided to take Mrs. Sherrill with her. Mrs. Johnson endorsed this theory. She said she found it odd that as the women were dying, Mrs. Sherrill was frantic to survive, while in contrast, Mrs. Austin seemed utterly indifferent to her fate. In addition, Mrs. Austin had recently visited the Jeffersonville Penitentiary to see her brother Sam Gore. He was serving a 10-year sentence for murder. A guard had heard her telling Gore that she would soon end her trouble. It was also noted that Emma had recently heavily insured her life, making her son the beneficiary. And why did she insist on sending Lloyd to school without breakfast, even though he wasn't feeling well? Others suggest that the victims were poisoned by one of the brothel's clients, possibly someone who had a motive to cover up his visit to the house. Two of the men who came by on the night before the poisonings spent the night, which would have made it easy for them to slip something unpleasant into the food before they left. After this theory was aired in the newspapers, it inspired half the males in town to visit the police stations, nervously denying that they had ever so much as laid eyes on Mrs. Austin's establishment, thus providing Louisville's wives with a handy guide to which of their husbands had a taste for bordellos. No first-class murder mystery is complete without nutty, anonymous letters to the authorities, and this one was no exception. On September 12th, the coroner received an unsigned letter which took the investigation into a whole new territory. Quote, "Dr. Barry, that poison was intended for Vince Spanninger and Mrs. Austin. He ate his meals there, and he has been keeping a woman for 20 years. She lives at 117 West Walnut, and they all had a fight, and it has not a more than. And she said that she would kill him if she caught him in the Austin house. Enclosed you will find some of the drug that was used. Now find out who used it, Spanninger's wife or Mrs. Cole or Nellie Cook. Nellie and her mother had the fuss about him. The only regret is that the poisoning of the innocent one. It is no secret about the way Spanninger and the Austin woman lived. All Second Street know it. Policeman Sweeney can tell you if you want to know if he will talk. Annie Myers, Betty Harper, John Snyder, Jake Dale. It is to be hoped you will find the guilty one." Unquote. Vince Spanninger was a Louisville produce merchant. Mrs. Austin's brother was located directly above his store. It was far from the first time this anonymous author had written about Spanninger's doings. For Vince, peddling vegetables was merely a way to make a living. His real profession was women. His romantic history was enough to make Casanova blush. For the past 10 years or so, this same anonymous writer had been sending Spanninger's unfortunate wife, Lizzie, letters chronicling her husband's many, many infidelities in great and, it turned out, extremely accurate detail. Policeman Sweeney, whose real name was actually Feeney, was asked about the anonymous writer's claims, and he did indeed talk. He was able to confirm that Spanninger was one of the two men who had stayed overnight at Mrs. Austin's house. It also emerged that Spanninger had suggested Emma make batter cakes for breakfast, but he declined to stay to eat any of them. The plot, as they say, thickened. Spanninger's lady friend at 117 West Walnut turned out to be 40-year-old Josephine Cole. Like Mrs. Austin, Cole was a madam, but on a more modest scale. She made the bulk of her income from giving psychic readings at 50 cents a pop. She readily told reporters that yes, indeed, she had been Vince Spanninger's mistress for the past 15 years, and furthermore, she had tried to keep him from marrying. By this point, Lizzie Spanninger was probably wishing Mrs. Cole had succeeded. She admitted that she'd been jealous of Vince's relationship with the late Mrs. Austin and confirmed that he had been the cause of the falling out between Emma and Nellie Cook. She professed to have no idea who had written all those anonymous letters chronicling Mr. Spanninger's every sordid move, but she intimated that whoever had deserved a medal. When questioned about the letters, Spanninger himself denounced them as a pack of lies. He had no idea who had poisoned Mrs. Austin and Mrs. Sherrill, but he did not believe Emma had committed suicide. Nellie Cook denied that she had argued with her mother and suggested that the letter writer, whoever he or she was, must also be the murderer. The four names at the end of the anonymous letter were questioned with little success. Betty Harper, a former prostitute, claimed not to have even known Mrs. Austin, and she certainly had no idea who had poisoned her. Annie Myers said much the same. John Snyder and Jacob Deal were business partners of Spanninger's. They both claimed to share the same convenient ignorance of the fact that a house of assignation had been operating over their store. However, Deal was able to provide the interesting information that Spanninger believed that he thought all those pesky anonymous letters were written by Josephine Cole. The drug the anonymous writer had included with the letter turned out to be arsenic. Did the writer get the arsenic elsewhere, or was it from the stash used as a murder weapon? On September 14th, two detectives called on Josephine Cole. They thought it was time to have a nice long chat. And while there, one of them noticed that the writing on a photo of Spanninger resembled that of the anonymous tattletale. When he asked if this was her writing, Mrs. Cole realized the game was up and it was time to confess all. Yes, she had written those letters to Mrs. Spanninger. Most of them, at least. Some, she claimed, were sent by yet another of Vince's mistresses, one Maggie Faulkner. The detectives then asked the obvious follow-up question. Where did she get the arsenic included with the letter? Mrs. Cole replied that on the morning Mrs. Austin cooked her last breakfast, Spanninger came to her house in an obviously agitated state. He told her that Mrs. Austin and Mrs. Sherrill were both going to die. When he took a handkerchief out of his pocket, he failed to notice that a brown paper packet fell out. Mrs. Cole presumed it was a love letter to another woman, so she managed to hide it with her foot until he left. When she opened the packet, she realized it contained poison. Mrs. Cole explained that she would have kept Vince's little secret if not for the fact that she subsequently learned that he had been far more than neighbors to Mrs. Austin. Although one would think the Casanova of the produce aisle's habits would have been old news to Mrs. Cole, she was enraged enough to send that informative letter to the coroner, along with a sample of the powder and a list of names she thought could also dish the dirt on Spanninger. She believed his motive for the murder was to get Mrs. Austin out of the way so he could spend more time with his latest amour, Nellie Cook. As a side note, Mrs. Cole was evidently unaware that her daughter Carrie was also said to have been Spanninger's mistress. As a result of this little tale, both Spanninger and Mrs. Cole found themselves under arrest. Spanninger denied every word of Mrs. Cole's story. In fact, he was positive she was the poisoner. And what of Nellie Cook, who, thanks to Mrs. Cole, was suddenly under scrutiny? She had bitterly quarreled with her soon-to-be-deceased mother. She'd thrown away the breakfast before it could be analyzed, and she had, shall we say, a colorful past. In 1886, she married a railroad worker named Gilbert Brockman. The pair spent their brief married life getting kicked out of various residences thanks to Nellie's reputation for immorality. And then there was the time Brockman, at his wife's urging, tried to murder one of her former lovers. In 1887, Brockman suddenly fell ill and died. The smart money assumed Nellie had poisoned him, but the doctors stubbornly stated that Brockman died of natural causes. This was beginning to look like one of those Agatha Christie stories where all the characters have a motive. Usually there's a hard time finding suspects in a murder case. 1892 Louisville was just lousy with suspects. When the inquest resumed on September 16th, it, like the earlier such inquiry, did little to clarify matters. Vince Spanninger denied any involvement with the crime. He claimed that he would have stayed to share the fatal breakfast if it had not been for the fact that he had important matters to attend to. When Nellie Cook was on the stand, she was asked why she threw out the breakfast leftovers, considering their obvious possible link to sudden illness of the two women. She replied that it didn't occur to her that her mother might be poisoned. She denied having any sort of romantic relationship with Spanninger. Dr. Brennan testified that Mrs. Austin's stomach had indeed contained arsenic, and so the coroner's jury delivered the inevitable verdict. The two women had been poisoned by a person unknown. There was a brief trial of Spanninger and Josephine Cole, which was no more illuminating than the inquest. Everyone who had spoken at the inquest repeated their stories. Mrs. Johnson, whose real name turned out to be Lydia Anderson, had fled town to avoid testifying at the inquest, but authorities managed to haul her back to take the stand. She proved to be as unhelpful as all the other witnesses. Her testimony indicated that Nellie Cook was far from grief-stricken by her mother's untimely end, and that Spanninger was in the habit of discreetly using Mrs. Austin's window rather than the staircase to enter her room. At the end of the proceedings, the judge could only sigh. "We have a world of evidence without a scintilla of proof." Enough dirty laundry had been produced to fill a million washing machines, but none of it was the slightest help with establishing who had poisoned Mrs. Austin's batter cakes. Everyone involved was set free to carry on their curious lives, and this complicated little murder mystery faded from public memory. Although many people had motive for the poisoning, only two of them had an evident opportunity. No poison was found in any of the ingredients used to make the batter cakes. Thus, it was reasoned the arsenic had to have been added to the batter itself, and the only people known to have been in the vicinity when the batter was made were Emma Austin and Vince Spanninger. Was this a murder-suicide? Did Mrs. Austin, resentful of Spanninger's likely attentions to the younger, prettier Mrs. Sherrill, decide to poison her rival and herself? Or did Spanninger, certainly a man with a lot to hide, have his own secret motives to be rid of the women? Or did someone else manage to sneak in to poison the batter unseen? Theorize away. While out jogging, Sherry Papini inexplicably disappeared. 22 days later, she returned home with a story so incredible it was hard to believe. In fact, some people still don't believe her after all these years. That story's up next on Weird Darkness. Sherry Papini, 34 years old, disappeared on November 2, 2016, whilst out jogging a mile from her home in Redding, California. She reappeared 22 days later at 4:30 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day near the town of Mountain Gale on November 24, 2016. Sherry told the police that she had been kidnapped by two Hispanic women, and a medical exam showed that she had been branded on her right shoulder, though it was unclear what the image was that had been burned into her skin. She had also lost a significant amount of weight during captivity. In the months that followed, the authorities cast some doubts on her story, though, given the unlikely details and inconsistencies of the reported abduction. The story remains a mystery today, as seemingly investigators still can't decide if Sherry was the victim of a kidnapping or if we are all victims of a hoax. But if it was a hoax, then what was the motive for it? If the abduction was faked, who harmed her so badly? Sherry's husband, Keith Papini, became concerned when he returned from his job at Best Buy on November 2, 2016 and did not find his wife at home. She also had not picked up the children from daycare. He used the Find My iPhone application to try and find out where she was by locating her cell phone. The app indicated her cell phone was at the intersection of Sunrise Drive and Old Oregon Trail, about a mile from their home. Keith said, "I couldn't find her, so I called the daycare to see what time she picked up the kids. The kids were never picked up, so I got freaked out. I hit the Find My iPhone app thing, I found her phone, it's got like hair ripped out of it, like in the headphones." When Keith went to retrieve the phone, it was placed on the ground and with the headphones tidily wrapped around it. He contacted the authorities on the assumption that something bad had happened to Sherry. 3 weeks later, in the early morning hours of November 24th, Sherry was found at the side of Country Road 17 near Interstate 5 in Yolo County. The location was 150 miles or about 240 kilometers south of where she disappeared and around 15 miles north of Sacramento. According to police, despite being chained, she'd managed to flag down a passing car. Sherry told police that she'd been held by two Hispanic women who took steps to keep their faces hidden from her, either by wearing masks or by keeping her head covered. Sherry said the two women armed with a handgun had abducted her, beat her, and held her captive in a basement before one of them finally left her on the side of the road. Sherry said the women had been driving a dark-colored SUV with a large rear side window at the time of the kidnapping, but she was unable to give details of the make and model. She seemed to have been physically abused during her captivity. She had been branded with a threatening message, her nose broken, her hair cut off. She also weighed only 87 pounds or 40 kilograms when she was found. The sheriff's office said Sherry appeared battered and bruised, her hair had been cut to shoulder length, and she had a brand on her right shoulder. Sherry, however, stated that she had not been sexually assaulted, and there's no physical evidence to indicate otherwise. The sheriff's office examined the brand on Sherry's shoulder and its possible meaning, but details remain confidential. Sketches of Sherry's alleged kidnappers were released in October 2017, 11 months after she was taken. One woman was described as being aged between 20 and 30 years old, 5 feet 5 inches tall, with curly, dark hair, thin eyebrows, and pierced ears. The second woman was between 40 and 50 years old, about 5 foot 7 inches tall, with long, straight black hair with some gray in it, thick eyebrows, and pierced ears. A medical examination of Sherry found there was male DNA on her person, but no other female DNA, seemingly at odds with her claim that two Mexican women abducted her. This male DNA was not her husband's, and Keith Papini volunteered for a polygraph and passed. Then a man called the Shasta County Sheriff's Office a few months after the alleged abduction, claiming that Sherry was with him for the entire 22 days when she was supposedly held captive by the Hispanic women. But this lead went nowhere. Still, it helped to seed doubts in the sheriff's office. The authorities were skeptical from the start about the abduction, even before she was found alive. They spent days focused almost entirely on an exchange on the Papini's computer that suggested she might have been involved with a man that she met online. Police found Sherry had been texting a man before her disappearance, and they tracked down the man in Detroit, Michigan on November 9th, a week after she disappeared. But the man was ruled out as a suspect in her disappearance, and the Shasta County Sheriff's Department refused to give further details. Sherry also appeared to have a troubled past. When she was 18 years old, her sister accused her of kicking in the back door of the family's Shasta Lake home. The same day, her parents, Richard and Loretta Graff, called the police to report the incident as vandalism and claimed that she had taken off to somewhere in Redding. When she was 21, her parents placed another call to the police, alleging that she had taken money from her father's bank account, which she later returned. Then Loretta reported Sherry was harming herself and blaming the injuries on her. Retired NYPD Sergeant Joseph Giacalone, and now a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, said that after Sherry was found, "I don't think they could find anything in the United States where that happened to someone. Generally, when kidnappings go on that long, they don't end as well as this one did." That no motive was ever revealed in the case is also perplexing, along with the $100,000 reward being offered in the case going unclaimed. When you're going to kidnap someone, you've got a reason for it, whether it's money, revenge, or to get back at somebody, Giacalone said. "A pair of female kidnappers is also very unusual," he said. Since authorities have indicated there's no public threat from the two women, Giacalone said that could suggest that Sherry knew her abductors. "Generally, when law enforcement doesn't say there's a public threat, they genuinely believe the person actually knows the perpetrator. Others criticized the investigation, one person saying, "The sheriff's office was so focused on that one lead that they forgot how to run an investigation. I'm not afraid to call out law enforcement when they're not doing their job, and the problem in this case is that law enforcement has failed miserably." Sherry Papini now remains at home with her husband Keith and son and daughters on the outskirts of Shasta Lake in Northern California. Neighbors have said that Sherry is now only seen outside infrequently and mostly stays home. Weirdo family member Dave Barton sent this one in. He calls it Autos. When I was 16, I got into a wreck in my dad's truck. I had my license for 1 week when this happened, and the truck was my dad's work truck. He had his own business. I was in deep trouble. Luckily for me, the guy who came to tow the truck was someone my dad had known from his teenage years. The man's name was Otto. So my dad rode with Otto since he wanted the truck towed to our house. When my dad had cooled off enough to talk to me, he told me about Otto and how that they had both been street racers. Was that a term used in the late 60s? Anyway, the main street in Salt Lake is State Street, and weekend nights, teenagers would cruise up and down State Street until they made it illegal. They also went to a local drag strip, so they didn't risk speeding tickets. One more ticket, no more license. He told me that Otto started a business called Otto's Auto and Marine, where he would fix cars, boats, build race cars, and towed cars. His shop was very successful. He was the only one who could test a boat engine under load at his shop. He basically had a big pool you could back a boat into and tie it down and run the engine, better than anyone else could do. He could have been considered a local legend in certain circles, obviously not to lawyers or white-collar guys, but anyone with an auto shop, marine shop, raced cars, or ran tow trucks knew about him. Had a good shop. Wish I had a shop like that. One kid in auto shop would wear an Auto's t-shirt, and I thought it was cool. Well, fast forward 15 years or so, I'm working as a small engine mechanic. The building we were in was being sold, and we had to move. We moved across the street, and that's when I found out where Otto's shop was. We were moving onto Otto's building. I did not know if Otto was even around anymore or not. I thought it was cool. This is also when I learned that I knew a lot more people than I thought who knew Otto. I was rebuilding the engine to my truck and took it to a machine shop, which is owned by a guy my dad and I know and have used before. Talking to him one day, I told him that we were moving into Otto's old shop. He got kind of quiet and told me it's too bad what happened to Otto. My work had hired a new delivery driver. Turns out, he'd married into Otto's family. He married Otto's niece. Between the two of those guys, I found out what had happened to Otto. Things were not going well in their marriage, and Otto killed his wife and himself. It was a shock that someone who seemed to have it all would do such a thing. Well, I guess the grass isn't greener on the other side, and you don't know what other people are really going through. Whatever the reason, it's sad. Well, the building faces north, the very west end of the building. Lower floor is the break room, salesman's office, and shop office, my office, which is directly right off the shop. Directly upstairs from that is where Otto and his wife had their offices. We did not use this area for anything other than storage. It was in disrepair and had basically been stripped down. I worked in the shop, which was, of course, right below the upstairs. There were windows that would allow people from upstairs to see into the shop. I could also see upstairs from the shop. Well, sometimes the lights would be on upstairs, and the other guys I worked with would try to freak each other out, saying that it was Otto's ghost. I just chuckled to myself that someone just forgot to turn off the lights, and that it's funny when people try to freak each other out. Now, in the shop, we had some shelving, riveter shelving, for storing parts on machines that were in for repair. You ever seen a busboy using those gray plastic totes to collect all the dishes from a table? Well, we used those bins on the shelves to make sure all the parts for a machine would stay in the same spot altogether and wouldn't get mixed up with parts from another machine. I mentioned that off the shop was an office. At the end of the day, I'd go into the office and enter my time and labor descriptions onto jobs, file for warranty emails, etc. I was usually the last person to leave as well. I don't remember what day or month it was, but it had to have been in the winter because it had gotten dark outside, and I never stayed late enough in the spring, summer, or fall months to be there when it was dark. Earlier in the day, a front wheel assembly came in for one of the riding mowers I was working on, a complete assembly, tire, rim bearings, shaft, etc., and I put it in the bin. Now, the tire was big enough that I couldn't just slip it into the bin with the limited space between the top of the bin and the bottom of the next upper shelf. I had to pull out the bin, put the tire in the bin, and then push the bin back. So, it was the end of the day, I was the last one in the building, it was locked up, I never liked being there alone without the doors locked. I was in my office doing the end-of-the-day work when I heard a bang in the shop, which scared the crap out of me, so I got up and went out to the shop and found the tire that I'd put in the bin earlier on the ground. The same tire that was big enough that I had to pull the bin out in order to put it in there. That tire was on the ground. I hurried and checked to see if anyone was in the sales office or front parking lot. Nobody was. I checked the rest of the building and the main parking lot. Nobody was there. Everything was locked. So what did I do? I went and put the tire back in the bin. I figured if I put the tire back, Otto's ghost wouldn't think that I was scared. But I was. I was freaking out. I went into the shop office to log out and shut down the computer. Could have gotten in trouble if I left the computer on overnight. Updates, you know. And I went home. I told my wife and family what had happened, but I never told anyone at my work about it until I quit. I didn't want Otto's ghost, if that's who it was, maybe it was his wife's ghost, but I'm sticking with Otto's ghost. Anyway, I didn't want Otto's ghost to know that he had really scared me. And it really did scare me. If he knew that, maybe it would have encouraged him to do it even more, and I didn't want that. I didn't quit because of it, I just got a better job opportunity. Now, I've never had any weird experiences, never seen a ghost or anything like that. I'd roll my eyes about people saying that something scary or paranormal would happen to them. Not literally, that'd be rude, I was rolling my eyes in my mind. I'm not saying there aren't spirits or ghosts or something out there. Too many stories, too many things that are unexplained for there not to be something out there. I just question the integrity of the people telling me, that's all. So if people roll their eyes at what happened to me and don't believe me, that's fine, I deserve it. But it really did happen, and it scared the crap out of me. I just wonder why nothing else happened to me or the others at my work. And I can't think of any other explanation of how that happened. Can you? Up next on Weird Darkness, when groups of sinister drones began hovering over homes in America's Midwest, the FBI, the U.S. Air Force, and 16 police forces set up a task force. But the drones vanished, and some wonder if they ever existed at all. At twilight, on New Year's Eve 2020, Placido Montoya, 35 years old, a plumber from Fort Morgan, Colorado, was driving to work. Ahead of him, he noticed blinking lights in the sky. He'd heard rumors of mysterious drones, whispers in his local community, but now he was seeing them with his own eyes. In the early morning gloom, it was hard to make out how big the lights were and how many were hovering above him. But one thing was clear to Montoya. He needed to give chase. As he approached the drones in his car, they took off very fast, and Montoya tried to follow. He confesses hitting 120 miles per hour before losing track of them. "They were really, really creepy," he says. "I don't know how to describe it, but it's almost as if they were watching us." That night, Vince Levinella, a deputy sheriff at Morgan County Sheriff's Office, received more than 30 calls from locals reporting drones zipping around all over the place. Levinella himself saw one with red, white, and green lights that he also tried to chase. "It outran me," he recalls. Meanwhile, neighboring Nebraska and Kansas were also dealing with their own mysterious drone swarms. From December 2019 to January 2020, residents of the three states were perturbed by multiple sightings of numerous unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, with wingspans of up to 6 feet, flying between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. in grid formations. On the same night that Levinella was receiving calls, a Nebraska deputy reported seeing 30 to 50 drones in the sky. Witnesses were alarmed by the size and speed of the vehicles. "It got to the point that we were fixing to take up arms," says Mike from Linden, Colorado, who wishes to retain partial anonymity. "But as quickly as the drones came, they disappeared." "That was it. They were gone," Montoya says. More than a year later, no one knows who was behind the drones. Despite an investigation involving the FBI, U.S. Air Force, and Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, there are no official answers. Amazon, Google, and Uber have denied involvement, and so did a local Air Force base. "Somebody's doing something and nobody's saying anything about it," Montoya summarizes. But even "somebody doing something" is now up for debate. One reporter claims the drones never existed at all. What really happened in the sky above the American Midwest in those fateful winter months? And what can the incident tell us about new technology and old fears? Did the mystery drones really exist? And if so, why can't anyone find out who was behind them? Is a new type of conspiracy theory being born? Are drones the new UFOs? First things first, there are videos. On YouTube, you can easily find footage of blinking lights hovering over houses, farms, and highways in Colorado. It's evident at least some of these lights belonged to drones, although it's harder to determine if these drones really were 6 feet wide. In early 2020, Douglas D. Johnson, a research affiliate with the Scientific Coalition for Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Studies, used America's Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, to uncover reams of FAA documentation about the drone mystery. Johnson's research revealed that law enforcement officers in 16 Colorado and Nebraska counties personally witnessed the drone activity, with one Kansas state trooper using night vision goggles to estimate one drone had a 10-foot wingspan. Brett Tingley is a journalist for The War Zone, a defense news publication. He believes the documents prove something strange did occur. There are consistencies among the eyewitness reports that suggest these drones possessed longer flight times than most off-the-shelf UASs, unmanned aircraft systems, he says. He believes the witness testimony appeared legitimate enough to local and state law enforcement and the FAA to take the sightings seriously. Still, that doesn't mean that there wasn't a frenzy. On January 29, 2020, Vice reporter Aaron Gordon published an article claiming the mysterious drone sightings were a classic case of mass hysteria. In an earlier article, he noted that the Colorado Department of Public Safety, CDPS, flew a multi-mission aircraft for nearly 5 hours in Colorado on January 6th that year and found no suspicious drone activity. Johnson calls the Vice article shoddy, but Tingley concedes that some sightings could have been hysteria, particularly after the drones made national news. Some officials even became a little hysterical. Deputies in Nebraska reported finding space potatoes after chasing drones through a field. In actual fact, the lumpy brown objects were a farming product used to fill irrigation ruts in fields. Lavanella agrees that hysteria built up quickly and says that some witnesses were undoubtedly looking at planes. But, quote, "I was irritated by people saying we didn't see nothing because that's not true. I know what was happening those first few days on the drones. They were there," unquote. By January 6th of 2020, a multi-agency task force had been set up to investigate. The FBI, Federal Aviation Authority, Air Force, and local law enforcement officials made up a team of 70. However, the task force disbanded by January 22nd after drone sightings dramatically dropped off. FAA Communications Manager Ian Greger now says, "We did not receive any information that enabled us to determine what exactly it was that people reported seeing, and if they were drones, who was flying them." In a separate investigation, the CDPS examined 23 drone sightings between the 6th and 13th of January and determined 13 sightings were planets, stars, or small hobbyist drones. 6 sightings were determined to be atmospheric conditions or identified commercial aircraft, while 4 sightings remained unidentified. Witnesses such as Placido Montoya aren't best pleased with the task force's inconclusive investigation, nor the CDPS's explanations. "I don't feel safe," he says. "I looked up and I felt like I was being violated." Lavanella stresses that investigations only began after sightings had died down and the drones had already moved on. Why is it so difficult to determine who is flying a drone? In 2018, Gatwick had to cancel hundreds of flights after drones were spotted by the runway. Chaos reigned between the 19th and 21st of December while police and the military investigated. On December 21st, a couple was arrested. They were later awarded $200,000 compensation for false imprisonment. On December 23rd, police said that it was a possibility that there was never a drone at all. In April 2019, police and Gatwick officials claimed the incident was potentially an inside job. James Scanlon is a design and engineering professor who runs Southampton University's Strategic Research Center in Autonomous Systems. He says if an individual is controlling a drone from the ground, then radio frequencies can be used to determine where the transmission is coming from. The problem comes when there's a drone that's flying with radio silence, so it's not transmitting. No one's transmitting to it. It might have a flight plan on board, so it executes its mission and doesn't need any control from the ground, he says. It's very hard to do anything about those. Clues can, of course, be found in the drones themselves, which is why witnesses in Colorado, Nebraska, and Kansas wanted to shoot them down. Because these drones were reportedly very large and very fast, some assumed they were military. In early January 2020, F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming denied ownership of the drones after inquiries from local newspapers. So who could possibly possess the kind of technology seen over the American skies that winter? Locals speculate about drug dealers, secret government operations, or even foreign spies. But Scanlon notes that you or I could purchase powerful drones ourselves. There's a commercial drone on the market called the Penguin B from a Latvia company that's about 6 foot in wingspan and has a very long endurance, so I could go and fly those tomorrow. To this day, Tingley still receives emails claiming the mysterious drones never went away. Mike, the witness from Linden, runs a 3,700-member Facebook group. "We still have people on there who've been keeping a very close eye on drone activity," he says. Mike says the drones interfered with his mobile phone connection and believes that they were equipped with audio surveillance. "Because the moment we identified the location and pointed a camera up there, they suddenly went blackout." Other witnesses have made similar claims. Mike says claims of mass hysteria are frustrating, but then references ufologist and conspiracy theorist Milton William Cooper. Asked if he himself identifies as a conspiracy theorist, Mike says, "No, I tend to vet pretty much every lead, and if I do not find credible evidence to support that lead, I will not push forward with it." 5 minutes later, he begins discussing footage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Take the frame-by-frame footages of the towers coming down and compare that to a controlled demolition. The individuals in Mike's Facebook group encompass everyone, from curious witnesses to people who believe the drones somehow caused the coronavirus. Some are self-confessed UFO enthusiasts. Mystery drones, after all, are unidentified flying objects by another name. In 2018, the top two websites for reporting UFOs revealed there had been a rapid decline in worldwide UFO sightings since 2014. In January 2019, drone researcher Fane Greenwood claimed this decline coincides with the period when relatively advanced drone technology first became truly accessible to consumers, in a Slate article entitled "Drones Are the New Flying Saucers." In emails about the mystery drones uncovered by Douglas, one FAA official remarked, "Not too long ago, we would have called these UFOs." Their colleague replied, "Yep, now everything is a drone." In her article, Greenwood explains that this is likely down to good old human psychology. If we see something we can't identify, we're likely to slot in whatever seems most plausible, and what seems plausible may change depending on current events and modern fears. Greenwood cites multiple instances in which pilots mistakenly reported drone sightings. In 2016, police reported that a passenger plane at Heathrow collided with a drone before the UK's transport minister clarified it may have even been a plastic bag. Conspiracy theory expert Daniel Jolly, a psychology professor at Northumbria University, says even when drone incidents are real, mystery can breed suspicion. When people hear about such things, they interpret this information in line with their prior beliefs. If you believe that powerful forces are up to shady things and generally have a mistrust of official information, you could be more likely to see a hidden motive. But Greenwood also believes we absolutely should be concerned about the malevolent use of consumer drones. Johnson says he's obtained documents from America's Nuclear Regulatory Commission that show there were 57 drone-related security events at NRC-licensed facilities between 2014 and 2019. Only 5 of these incidents were deemed resolved. He also has discovered that on 2 nights in September 2019, security guards reported seeing a number of drones flying over the largest power plant in the U.S., Palo Verde Generating Station in Arizona. In January 2021, a year after Montoya first saw drones in the night sky, the Pentagon released a new strategy to counter small drones, with official documents stating, "Technology trends are dramatically transforming legitimate applications of small drones while simultaneously making them increasingly capable weapons in the hands of state actors, non-state actors, and criminals." Many of the Freedom of Information Act documents obtained by Johnson were redacted, including witness photographs of drones in F.E. Warren documents. So was the whole thing real or imagined? A conspiracy or a covert operation? Could it even be a bit of both? Some suspicious drone hobbyists believe the FAA itself orchestrated the mystery so they could enforce tighter regulations. On December 26, 2019, the FAA proposed that all but the smallest drones should broadcast tracking signals to allow them to be remotely identified. One thing is evident: drones, real or imagined, are capable of causing chaos. "What caught me off guard is we have no answers to this day, and it's like everybody's okay with it," Montoya says. At first he thought Amazon was behind the drones. Now he wonders whether it could be the government or foreign powers. And then he offers up one final theory. "Could have been aliens," he says, with a laugh. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and the show's Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story or call the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. And if you're listening on the radio, be sure to also subscribe to the podcast where I upload episodes 7 days a week. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. The brothel poisoning was posted at Strange Company. The litigating witch case is from esoterics.com. Attack of the Drones is by Amelia Tate for theguardian.com. The Sherry Papini mystery is posted at strangeoutdoors.com. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Psalm 5, verse 12. "Surely, Lord, you bless the righteous. You surround them with your favor as with a shield." And a final thought: you don't love someone for their looks or their clothes or their fancy car, but because they sing a song only you can hear. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show, and if you're already a member of this weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, sightings of a strange flying creature have been reported in Maryland since back in the 1700s. But even stranger is the unfortunate name this creature has been tagged with. What the heck is a snallygaster? They say it's actually safer to fly than to drive on our country's highways. And seeing how Chicagoans drive, I might tend to believe that. But when something goes wrong in your car, you don't plunge 30,000 feet to your demise. And while it may be safer than driving, there are still a lot of things that cannot go as planned and leave you screaming towards your doom. Of course, more can go wrong on a flight than just you dying, although that probably should be at the top of the list of things to avoid when traveling by air. But some other strange and bizarre things have also happened in the skies that might make you rebook your next vacation on a train instead. In many cultures, there are stories of screaming skulls haunting and terrorizing people. What could this phenomenon be? And are all the incidents related? Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. For centuries, a large winged beast known as the snallygaster is said to have terrified the people of Frederick County, Maryland. The dragon-like beast is described as being a half-reptile and half-bird that lives deep in the caves of South Mountain. The mysterious creature is said to swoop silently down from the sky, stealing farm animals and children from the unsuspecting farm folk. Some say it's real. The area was settled by German immigrants beginning in the 1730s who called the creature a Schnellergeist, meaning quick spirit in German. The earliest folklore mixes the half-bird features with nightmarish features of demons and ghouls. Other descriptions describe the beast as half-reptile, half-bird, with a metallic-like beak lined with razor-sharp teeth. Sometimes it's described as having octopus-like tentacles. The earliest stories claim that this monster sucked the blood of its victims. The snallygaster has one widely known enemy called Dweyo. The Dweyo is reported to be a mammalian biped with features similar to a wolf but the stance and stature of a human. Sounds like a werewolf to me. The Dweyo and the snallygaster have reportedly had vicious encounters dating back to the early settlement of the Middletown Valley. For years, the snallygaster lived only on the pages of folklore until 1909, when stories of the beast began to appear in newspapers. Encounters between local residents and the winged creature in February and March of 1909 described it as having enormous wings, a long, pointed bill, claws like steel hooks, and an eye in the center of its forehead. Further, it was said to make screeches like a locomotive whistle. A February 1909 article claimed that a man had been seized by the winged creature, which proceeded to sink its teeth into his jugular and drain the body of blood before dropping it along a hillside. The story was carried prominently in Middletown, Maryland's Valley Register, and soon spread far and wide, so much so that the Smithsonian Institution offered a reward for the hide and U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt reportedly considered postponing an international trip to personally hunt the beast. In the early issues, the flying beast seemed to be everywhere at once. In New Jersey, it was reported that its footprints were first discovered in the snow. In West Virginia, it was said that the flying beast almost caught a woman near Scrabble, was found roosting in a farmer's barn, and laid an egg the size of a barrel near Sharpsburg. A man in Cass-town, Ohio, wrote a letter to the Valley Register telling of a strange creature that flew over his area, making terrible screeching noises. He described it as having two huge wings, a large horny head, and a tail 20 feet long. In Maryland, it was sighted by a man who operated a brick-burning kiln near Cumberland. Spied near the kiln, sleeping, when it awoke, it emitted a blood-curdling scream and angrily flew away. It was only sighted near Hagerstown, south of Middletown at Lover's Leap, and seen flying over the mountains between Gapland and Burkittsville, where it was reported to have laid another very large egg. The last sighting in Frederick County occurred in March 1909, where three men fought the creature outside a railroad station for nearly an hour and a half before chasing it into the woods of Carroll County. Afterward, there were no more sightings of the mysterious creature for the next 23 years, at which time it once again appeared in Frederick County, Maryland. The first reports said the bird was seen just below South Mountain in Washington County. It was surmised at the time that, as the life expectancy of a Snallygaster was estimated at about 20 years, not sure how they came up with that, the new sightings were from the offspring of the 1909 creature. At this time, the Middletown Valley Register requested that local residents who spied the creature should provide as accurate and detailed a description as possible for scientific purposes. Two residents soon reported having seen it just east of Braddock Heights, flying about 25 feet overhead, confirming the descriptions published the previous week. The next thing heard of the Snallygaster is that it had died in Washington County when it was overcome by the fumes of a moonshine still and fell from the sky into the 2,500-gallon vat of alcohol. According to the story, revenue agents soon arrived and destroyed both the vat and the carcass of the beast. No appearances have been reported since. They say it's actually safer to fly than to drive on our country's highways. And seeing how Chicagoans drive, I might tend to believe that. But when something goes wrong in your car, you don't plunge 30,000 feet to your demise. And while it might be safer than driving, there are still a lot of things that cannot go as planned and leave you screaming towards your doom. That's up next on Weird Darkness. Hey Weirdos, Weird Darkness has been nominated for a podcast award in four categories this year: Storyteller Drama, Society and Culture, True Crime, and the coveted People's Choice category. You can vote for Weird Darkness in all four categories at the same time by visiting podcastawards.com. Once you sign up to vote, you'll find all four categories in the left-hand column, People's Choice at the very top, and then bottom left-hand column for the remaining three when you scroll down. While it's still on your mind right now, please, go vote. Only you, my weirdo family, can help Weird Darkness become an award-winning podcast this year. Go to podcastawards.com and vote for Weird Darkness in the Storyteller Drama category, the Society and Culture category, the True Crime category, and the People's Choice category. And thank you, weirdo family, for nominating and voting for Weird Darkness.
Good day, everyone. This is your captain speaking. We'll be leaving the gate shortly for our 3-hour flight. The weather looks fine, so we should be looking at a smooth, comfortable ride.
Well, yeah, unless he doesn't de-ice the wings before takeoff, or gets disoriented and thinks the ocean is the horizon, or misses the runway at landing, or, well, here are a few ways that your pilot might kill everybody on board. Brace for impact. It takes a special pilot to get passengers killed before even attempting a takeoff. On December 3, 1990, at Detroit's Wayne County Airport, Northwest Airlines Flight 1482, piloted by Captain William Lovelace and First Officer James Shifferns, was set to depart from Pittsburgh with 40 passengers. The day was notable for its dense, low-hanging fog, but nothing the DC-9 couldn't quickly outclimb. Departing its gate, Flight 1482 headed for runway 3C, but instead turned onto another taxiway. To correct the error, they were instructed to make a right to double back. Apparently not satisfied with one dumb mistake, Lovelace and Shifferns instead somehow managed to turn directly onto the active runway. They realized the mistake and contacted air traffic control, who, duh, told them to leave the runway immediately. 5 seconds later, Northwest Flight 299, a Boeing 727 taking off en route to Memphis, came barreling toward them. The 727's wing sliced through the right side of Flight 1482, cutting through the fuselage just below the windows. It then chopped off the DC-9's right engine. Flight 299's pilot, who, it must be said, performed phenomenally, initiated a rejected takeoff and stopped the aircraft safely. Its 146 passengers and 8 crew were all unhurt. The DC-9 caught fire and was destroyed. 7 passengers and 1 flight attendant died, with another 10 seriously injured. In addition to Lovelace's culpability, the ensuing investigation criticized the airport's control tower for failure to use progressive taxi instructions in low visibility. Making sure that ice is not accumulated on an airplane's wings is such a crucial and common occurrence that even back in the comparably cowboyish 1980s, commercial cockpits contained clearly marked ice protection systems. Unfortunately, Captain Larry M. Wheaton managed to overlook this standard pre-flight checklist item despite more than 8,000 hours of airtime under his belt, and despite the fact that it was snowing. On the afternoon of January 13, 1982, Washington, D.C.'s National Airport was just reopening after a deluge of the same white stuff currently accruing on the wings of Wheaton's Air Florida Flight 90 bound for Fort Lauderdale with 74 passengers. The experienced pilot he was, Wheaton recognized his error shortly after leaving the gate. But instead of returning for proper de-icing, he and First Officer Roger Pettit had a novel idea: to use the exhaust from the plane ahead of them in the takeoff queue to defrost their wings. How resourceful! The shockingly unsound judgment didn't stop there. Wheaton decided to proceed with takeoff even after his impromptu de-icing attempt predictably failed, and after detecting a power problem while taxiing. Flight 90 took off and began climbing to about 350 feet. Then it lost lift. The Boeing 737 dropped from the sky and slammed into an overpass before plunging into the Potomac River. 70 passengers and 4 crew members died, including both pilots. 4 motorists on the ground were also killed. Only 5 survivors were plucked by a helicopter from the frigid river, though as many as 19 likely survived the initial crash. On August 20, 2008, Captain Antonio Garcia Luna and First Officer Francisco Javier Mulet did everything right, then did everything wrong. Unfortunately, the latter was irredeemable. Span Air Flight 5022 was a McDonnell Douglas MD-82, carrying 166 passengers and 6 crew from Barcelona to Madrid. It was scheduled to leave an hour earlier than it did, as the pilots had wisely abandoned a departure due to an excessive reading from the RAM air temperature (RAT) probe. The aircraft was taken to a parking area, where maintenance workers deactivated the RAT probe's heater, which was fine since no ice buildup would occur on a fair-weather August day in Spain. Then Luna and Mulet both forgot to deploy the flaps and slats required for takeoff. Without these high-lift devices, the wings could not generate enough lift to keep the aircraft airborne. It didn't help that the warning system malfunctioned, failing to alert the crew of their mission-critical mistake. Flight 5022 left the ground momentarily, rolled sharply to the right, and smashed into the ground beside the runway. The wings separated, and the fuselage snapped into 2 parts, the larger of which was engulfed by fire. The asinine accident killed 154 people. Only 18 survived. On June 1, 2009, Air France Flight 447 took off from Brazil's Rio de Janeiro airport en route to Paris. The Airbus A330 was carrying 216 passengers and 12 crew, including three flight-trained officers rather than the typical two. The flight comprised 13 hours of duty, and Air France's policy was that pilots can serve no more than 10 hours before taking a break. The extra first officer allowed for two qualified personnel to fly the plane at all times. Captain Marc Dubois took the mid-flight break shift while the plane was over the Atlantic Ocean. Just 15 minutes later, First Officer David Robert summoned him back. During his brief absence, the plane had entered turbulent airspace and was also accruing ice on the wings. The plane had begun to stall, and the two pilots, neither of whom were captains, reacted incorrectly. Just before Dubois re-entered the cockpit, co-first officer Pierre-Cédric Bonin exclaimed, expletive, "I don't have control of the airplane anymore now." Dubois' first words upon returning were not encouraging. Noticing the various alarms going off, he asked, "What are you doing?" The aircraft had its nose above the horizon but was descending, steeply. Soon after this, Robert said, "Climb," four consecutive times. Bonin replied, "But I've been at maximum nose up for a while." When Captain Dubois heard this, he realized Bonin was causing the stall and shouted, "No, don't climb! No, no, no!" Flight 447 crashed into the ocean, killing everyone aboard. Had a captain-level pilot been in the cockpit, it never would have happened. It should be far harder to kill 264 people than 26-year-old First Officer Wang Mengzheng's simple error. On April 26, 1994, he and Captain Wang Lo-Chi were in the home stretch of China Airlines Flight 140 from Taipei, Taiwan to Nagoya, Japan. The flight had been uneventful, and the Airbus A300 was descending into Nagoya on time and at a safe angle. That all changed just 3 miles from the runway. At an altitude of 1,000 feet, First Officer Mengzheng inadvertently selected the takeoff-slash-go-around setting, which at that height is instructing the plane's aircraft autopilot to increase the throttles for a second pass at the landing. The crew reacted by manually reducing the throttles and pushing the yoke forward. But the autopilot, acting on the inadvertent go-around command, countered by increasing its own efforts to overcome the pilot's actions. It moved the horizontal stabilizer to a full nose-up position. Still unaware of the autopilot's go-around command, the crew then independently decided to go around. The result was a compounded action that raised the plane's nose far too high. The steep pitch caused an aerodynamic stall, and Flight 140 dropped like a brick. Only seven of the plane's 271 occupants lived. Crashing into another bad pilot in midair. What are the chances, right? Well, apparently, up until the mid-1950s, those chances were quite good. Then one collision led to much-needed changes. On June 30, 1956, a TWA Super Constellation and a United DC-7 carrying a combined 128 people collided over the Grand Canyon in Arizona at 21,000 feet. The TWA plane's tail was sheared off, while most of the United flight's left wing was severed. The TWA Super Constellation plunged in a near-vertical dive, crashing onto a plateau 300 feet above the Colorado River. The United DC-7 sputtered another mile or so before slamming into a butt and careening into a rugged gulch. Everyone perished. It doesn't seem difficult for two planes to avoid each other in the air, especially in the less crowded skies of the mid-20th century, but such mid-air massacres had become a trend. A 1956 Aviation Week article noted that between 1948 and 1955, there were 127 mid-air collisions in the U.S., 30 of which involved commercial airliners. In the aftermath of the TWA United disaster, investigators determined that although the pilots had simply failed to see each other, not really sure how, America's antiquated air traffic control system was also a factor. Fallout from the accident led directly to the 1957 formation of the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board. It's a bit harsh to call the crew of Eastern Airlines Flight 401 dim bulbs, but this might be the flat-out stupidest reason a commercial airliner ever crashed. On December 29, 1972, Flight 401, a Lockheed TriStar carrying 163 passengers and 13 crew members from New York City's John F. Kennedy Airport, was beginning its approach into Miami. Upon lowering the landing gear, First Officer Albert Stockstill noticed that the gear indicator, a green light confirming the nose gear is locked in place, had not illuminated. There were three trained commercial aviators on the flight: First Officer Stockstill, Flight Engineer Donald Repo, and Captain Robert Loft, a 32-year veteran. Loft told the Miami Flight Tower about the landing gear situation and received permission to go into a holding pattern at 2,000 feet. He sent Repo down to the avionics bay to report on the landing gear's position, then told Stockstill to engage the autopilot while they removed the light assembly. Only the autopilot was on the wrong setting. Instead of circling at a steady altitude, it descended so gradually that no one noticed until the plane crashed into the Everglades. Loft's final words, recorded 10 seconds before the crash, were, "Hey, what's happening here?" "Oh, nothing, Captain. You're just getting everyone killed because none of the three pilots could bother to look out the window." 101 people died. The landing gear indicator issue was later determined to be a simple burned-out bulb. And even if it wasn't, the gear could have been lowered manually. Despite the comparative complexity of the landing process, modern cockpit instruments significantly simplify its execution, making both approach and touchdown as automated as possible. Such tools have helped make air travel the safest means of transportation, unless, of course, the pilot misuses that technology. On February 9, 2009, Captain Marvin Renslow and a scarily young First Officer, 24-year-old Rebecca Shaw, were beginning their descent into Buffalo, New York on Colgan Air Flight 3407 from Newark, New Jersey. The Bombardier Dash 8 was carrying 49 passengers, a packed flight for the relatively small commercial aircraft. Upstate New York is frigid in winter, and the airline's policy called for landings to be performed manually in conditions likely to cause ice accumulation on the wings. Despite this, Renslow kept the plane on autopilot as it slowed for landing, and slowed, and slowed, until the shaker stick, a warning system intended to jolt the pilot to attention, warned of an impending mid-air stall. Renslow, who should have already been manually guiding the aircraft, responded by abruptly pulling back on the control column and increasing thrust to 75% power, neither of which was the right thing to do. The proper stall recovery technique is lowering the nose and applying full power. Flight 3407 pitched up, down, left, and then rolled violently right. It crashed into a house and burst into flames, killing everyone on board and one on the ground. Notably, the flight became a rallying call for pilots to receive more rest between flights, as fatigue was among the factors blamed for Renslow's deadly mistakes. Nearly half of all fatal crashes happen during final descent and landing, by far the most dangerous leg. As the plane descends, the most important job for a pilot is to ensure the aircraft's angle and alignment head directly onto the runway. On September 27, 1977, the captain of Japan Airlines Flights 715 was attempting to do just that as the plane approached Malaysia's Sultan Abdul Aziz Shah Airport. The weather was poor, so Flight 715 was on a VOR approach, which provides lateral guidance until the plane reaches its MDA, or minimum descent altitude. From there, pilots are instructed to maintain that altitude until the runway comes into view. The idea is to get below the cloud cover, but not so far below that the aircraft is endangered. Flight 715's MDA was 750 feet. Landing gear down and flaps extended, the DC-8 jet dropped to 750 feet. Then it kept dropping. At 300 feet, it crashed into a hill 4 miles from the airport. The plane broke apart and burst into flames. Incredibly, only 34 of the 79 people aboard perished. The cause of the crash was simple. The pilot descended below his minimum descent altitude without having the runway in sight. Instead of aborting the approach and circling back, the pilot took the plane to a height of a medium-sized Manhattan office building. Investigators also blamed the first officer for doing nothing to stop this flagrant procedural violation. And finally, plenty of deadly crashes occur just as planes touch down, typically because they over- or undershoot the runway. However, a deadly landing accident in 2020 occurred for an especially unusual reason. On May 22, 2020, Pakistani International Airlines Flight 8303 was descending into Karachi from Lahore, carrying 91 passengers and 8 crew members. The Airbus A320's descent was abnormally abrupt, unnerving air traffic controllers as the plane approached the runway. Then, unnerved turned to mortified. Captain Sajjad Ghul and First Officer Usman Azam were about to land without landing gear, despite the multitude of procedures and warnings designed to prevent exactly that. It is unbelievable to me that an airline crew on a jet like an Airbus with all the warning systems would attempt to land the plane without the gear extended, said John Cox, an aviation safety consultant. The plane's two engines grinded along the runway at speeds exceeding 200 miles per hour, 40 miles per hour faster than an Airbus should land, with or without wheels. Amazingly, the pilots were able to reascend away from the airport, but only briefly. The plane lost power, maybe it was that whole engines grinding the pavement at high speeds thing, and crashed into a nearby neighborhood, killing one person on the ground. Only 2 passengers lived. Of course, more can go wrong on a flight than you just dying, although that probably should be at the top of the list of things to avoid when traveling by air. But some other strange and bizarre things have also happened in the skies that might make you rebook your next vacation on a train instead. I'll share some of those incidents when Weird Darkness returns. We got a quick call on the dark line, and it's a good one.
This is Donna from Deadwood, South Dakota. I love your show and just was listening to Ghosts of the Old West and just had to comment about the story about Seth Bullock haunting Deadwood, South Dakota. When I heard you say legend has it, I had to chuckle. In 2004, my son was working there at the Bullock Hotel, and he worked mostly in the kitchen but sometimes helped the housekeepers cleaning the guest rooms. He had heard all the rumors about the place being haunted, heard personal experiences from the staff, yet he was still a skeptic. Until the day that he was helping 2 housekeepers clean room 313. When they got into a discussion about the hotel being haunted, especially that room, my son said to them he didn't believe in ghosts. Suddenly, the plug to the vacuum cleaner he was holding came shooting out of the wall and hit him lightly in the face as if to say, how about now? He's been a believer ever since.
Just because you don't believe in something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Sounds like your son found that out the hard way, Donna. Thank you for a great story. If you have a true paranormal or creepy story to share of your own, you can do what Donna did and call the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. Anyone who travels often enough will eventually run into a bad experience when they fly, even if it doesn't end in your death. Annoying passengers and grumpy employees are 2 of the usual suspects. Such hassles are as much a part of flying as pat-downs and those pre-flight safety demonstrations that very few passengers pay any mind to. However, as the next few stories will show us, putting over 100 people in a confined space for an extended period of time can sometimes lead to some truly strange and awful circumstances. Even as the experience of flying continues to decline, incidents like these stand out from the crowd. In 2016, a man was taking a flight from Algiers to Paris, and he tried to smoke a cigarette on board. Despite the fact that smoking on planes has been banned for years, he believed he was above the rules. He was told by employees that smoking was not allowed and was asked to stop. He wasn't allowed to have alcohol either. That made him angry. So, how did this man express his anger? he unzipped his pants and urinated on a fellow passenger. The victim stood up and punched the man, and they began to fight. Passengers took photos on their phones of the man who started all the trouble being held down by employees. For some reason, the unruly passenger also took his shirt off before letting loose, so to speak. The airplane had to land early in Lyon so that the man could be detained by authorities. A 20-year-old college student was on a flight from Malaysia in March 2018 when he pulled up his laptop to watch a movie. That's perfectly normal, except that he was watching porn. Also, he stripped naked. An employee quietly asked him to stop, so he quickly put his clothes back on. It's possible that this man felt like he could get away with almost anything on this flight because he didn't exactly get in trouble for the porn. Later, he tried to hug a stewardess and grope her. She pushed him away, and when he was rejected, he began attacking her. The other employees grabbed him and detained him until they landed. He was handed over to police custody. For years, people have been bringing strange animals on airplanes with a doctor's note, claiming them to be emotional support animals. Now, in many cases, these pet owners have very little regard for fellow passengers, and pigs, ducks, turkeys, and other exotic pets on planes have become an issue. In January 2018, United Airlines finally decided to put their foot down when a performance artist tried to bring a peacock on the flight, claiming that she desperately needed the bird sitting next to her for her emotional well-being. She was denied a seat on the flight and asked to leave. Not even traditional pets are safe to fly without a kennel anymore. In June 2017, a large dog that was brought on a flight as an emotional support animal bit another passenger. Delta Airlines now requires a 48-hour notice before bringing an animal on board, as well as documentation from a licensed medical professional with a true reason for why the animal should be on the flight. The support animal also must be up to date with vaccinations and have received training certifications for actual medical issues like blindness. In March 2018, employees of United Airlines spotted passengers holding a 10-month-old French bulldog puppy inside a carrying kennel. It's not against the rules to carry a small dog in a carrier, and nothing has changed about that, even with the new regulations about support animals. However, a United Airlines employee took it upon themselves to insist that they needed to put the kennel in the overhead luggage area so that it was far away from other passengers. When the flight was over, the dog's owner stood up to take down the carrier, and the dog was dead. She collapsed on the aisle floor, sobbing. United Airlines issued an apology, saying that they never told their employees that pets should be in overhead bins, and they are just as shocked as everyone else. They also said they'll make sure it never happens again. Everybody poops. But as was the case on one British Airways flight in 2015, some stink far more than others. Very early into a 7-hour flight from Heathrow to Dubai, a passenger went number 2 in the airplane toilets. The appropriate place to do it, of course. Before long, the pilot made an announcement, asking for the managing employees to come to the cockpit to talk. After a few minutes of discussion, the pilot made the announcement that the smell of someone's liquid fecal excrement was so pungent that it could already be smelled at the front of the plane because of the recycled air. Considering that they were in the beginning of a 7-hour flight, he felt that for the personal health and safety of the passengers, they needed to turn around and go back to Heathrow Airport. They'd only been in the air for 30 minutes. Everyone was asked to leave the plane, and the passengers were given free hotel rooms for the night before boarding a new and less pungent flight the next day. Almost everyone who travels often enough has had to endure a crying baby or unruly child on an airplane kicking the back of your seat, but this story takes the cake. In 2017, a passenger filmed a toddler who was climbing on seats, running up and down the aisles, grabbing at the ceiling air vents, and screaming nonstop for almost all of the 8-hour flight. According to witnesses who described the child's screams as demonic, the mother quietly asked the boy to be quiet and sit down without being forceful or stern. When the stewardess asked the mother to please control her child, she replied that he had behavioral issues and countered that they should turn the in-flight Wi-Fi on so that he could play games on the iPad to distract him. This incident has sparked a debate over whether families with children should be placed in a separate section of airplanes from other passengers. When the campy thriller Snakes on a Plane premiered in 2006, Samuel L. Jackson fans loved how funny and over-the-top this idea was, and quotes from the movie are well-known, even to those who never saw it. However, in 2016, that nightmarish scenario became all too real when passengers on a Mexican flight spotted a green snake dangling from the overhead baggage compartment. One of the passengers pulled out his phone to capture the moment, though when the snake began to drop, he unbuckled his seatbelt and got away from it as quickly as he could. Thankfully, everybody kept their distance from the snake and no one was bitten. The plane had to make an emergency priority landing in Mexico City. The employees tried to investigate how the snake got onto the plane in the first place, but it's still a bit of a mystery. In March 2018, the cargo on a flight taking off from Yakutsk, Russia was possibly too heavy for the latch of the plane's door to handle because it suddenly began flying out onto the runway. But this wasn't just any cargo. It was gold bars, gems, and precious metals. Altogether, the items that fell off the plane were valued at $368 million. It all belonged to a Canadian mining company which had paid to transport their goods. An airline employee took a video on his phone showing an entire runway littered with valuables. Considering that the plane flew a few miles from the airport before landing, it's possible that some of that money fell onto some random person's land and they thanked God for their good fortune. Let's just hope they needed that money more than the mining company did. On a JetBlue flight from California to Florida, passengers began to smell an unknown odor coming from the cockpit. The smell continued to circulate throughout the plane to the point where people began coughing and choking. It was so bad that they had to make an emergency stop in Oklahoma City, where two passengers and three crew members had to be taken to the hospital. Several more people needed to be given oxygen. The rest of the passengers had to wait to be put on a new flight. And the source of the odor could not be determined. And I have saved the most infamous for last, the story most all of you have heard of, but it has to be mentioned. In 2017, United Airlines Flight 3411 needed to make room for four employees who had to make it to Louisville, the plane's destination. The airline offered reimbursement in the form of vouchers, as well as a free hotel room and a seat on a later flight for any who volunteered to get off. But there were no takers. Ultimately, they randomly chose four people to kick off the flight. One of them was Dr. David Dow, a single passenger who was already in his seat. He was told by employees to leave, to make room for someone else. He rightly refused to leave his seat and tried calling United Airlines customer service on the phone. He told them that he could not leave the flight, saying he was a doctor who had to see his patients at the clinic the next morning. Ultimately, three Chicago Department of Aviation security officers approached him, physically yanking him out of his seat. During the altercation, Dow's head was smashed against the armrest. He screamed, and the employees ignored his cries that he was bleeding. Passengers were outraged, pulling out their phones to capture the moment on film. Dow was left with a broken nose, two front teeth knocked out, and a concussion. After the incident, United Airlines' stock price plummeted. Dow sued the airline, and they settled for an undisclosed amount of money. When Weird Darkness returns, in many cultures, there are stories of screaming skulls haunting and terrorizing people. What could this phenomenon be? And are all the incidents related? That's up next. For thousands of years, across many different cultures across the world, people have believed that the head or a skull has held the soul. Some tribes would preserve the skulls of their fallen enemies, and the Celts would decorate their shrines with skulls. In Britain, they have a strange folklore of skulls that scream if taken from the location where they were held. At Wardley Hall in Lancashire, the skull of 16th-century Catholic martyr Father Ambrose Barlow is on view at the head of the staircase with the legend that if anybody removes the skull, it will emit a blood-curdling scream. The screaming skull of Burton Agnes Hall. Now, according to legend, Burton Agnes Hall in Yorkshire has another screaming skull legend, this one belonging to Anne Griffiths. After being attacked and beaten by robbers, Anne, in her dying breaths, expressed the wish that her head should be buried in the home that she so much loved. Nevertheless, her family buried her in the village churchyard. After the funeral, terrifying groans and poltergeist activity such as doors slamming and crashes were heard around the house. The dead girl's body was exhumed and her skull was exhumed and bricked up in a wall off the staircase, although in recent times the skull has been on display without any side effects. The Screaming Skull of Bettiscombe Manor. Bettiscombe Manor in Dorset probably has the most famous screaming skull legend in Britain. The Bettiscombe skull story starts in the 18th century when a member of the Pinney family returned from living in the West Indies and returned with a black slave. Shortly after returning, the slave died after making his master swear that he would be buried in his homeland. The squire broke his promise, and the slave was buried in the local churchyard instead. Similar to that of the Burton Agnes skull, the skull of the slave began to make agonizing screams that so much disturbed passers-by they asked the squire to make amends. Since the skull has remained on show at Bettiscombe Manor, as with many legends, the truth is often very different from the legend. Analysis during the 1960s confirmed that the skull was in fact 2,000 years old and was that of a girl. The legend, however, remains intact that if the skull is ever removed from the manor, the person who moves it will die within a year. Then there's the Celtic tradition of the Death's Head. The power of the Death's Head certainly dates back to prehistory and when our ancestors believed that the skull contained the soul, but also the skull is very important in magic. In Papua New Guinea, widows would impale their dead husbands' skulls on poles to ward away spirits and unwanted attention. In England, the trail of the witch Anne Chaddix, head of a family of Lancashire witches, was accused of digging up three skulls from a churchyard to use in some ritual or demonic recipe. For this, she was hanged. The Celts often took the heads of enemies killed in battle and kept those both as trophies and as offerings to the gods. The great stone shrine at Rocapertuse had skull niches in the wall, some filled with representations of heads and others filled with actual skulls. Throughout the years, the skull has been seen as a mascot, trophy, or charm, and this is represented within the Screaming Skulls legends that still linger on in England today. And we'll end with a story from one of our Weirdo family members. Travis Heckel sent this one in. He titled it, Are Angels Real? Hey Darren, I've been debating on sending this or not, since it's not dark or weird, but deals with angels. I was on the patio the other night listening to an episode of Weird Darkness when my 14-year-old daughter came out to ask what I was listening to. It was the episode about the beast of the land between the lakes, since we had just returned home from a lake in Kentucky and thought it'd be fun listening while sitting outside in the dark. She listened to the story with me and said, "You should send them my angel story." While I've told several people, friends and family, I never thought about sharing it to a nationwide audience, but after thinking it over, maybe it can give some relief to those that might question their faith or just may be curious about the afterlife. When our daughter was 2, I had to take her to the eye doctor with me to pick up my new contact lenses. It wasn't a small office eye doctor, but a large chain-type eye center. They have a large waiting area with around 7 rows of chairs, with about 10 chairs in each row. Since it was just opening, they had it on Disney, so we sat in the front row so I could keep her occupied for a few moments while I finished up some paperwork. While doing my paperwork, the door opened and in walked 2 men. I curiously turned to see who was walking in and saw a normally dressed man accompanied by another man that looked disheveled, possibly homeless, but otherwise didn't pay attention and continued with my paperwork. Just then, my daughter stood up in the chair and turned around and started staring at the disheveled man. She then bent down and whispered in my ear, "Dad, that man right there is an angel." It took me by surprise, and I asked her what she said. She repeated, "That man right there is an angel." So she did say that. It gave me a bit of a chill, and I didn't really want to turn around to stare, although she kept wanting to keep looking at him. I don't have a fabulous ending to this story, like this angel miraculously cured everyone's eyesight to 20/20 vision, but I sometimes look back at that moment. While I'm not an overly religious person, I still consider myself a Christian, but at the time, we had yet to take my daughter to church. She obviously knew of God as we prayed and such before meals, but they say the innocent see things that us sinners look over. So for those out there that might be questioning their religion or faith, maybe this story will help. That maybe we do have a guardian angel out there looking over us after all. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and the show's Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story or call the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. And if you're listening on the radio, be sure to also subscribe to the podcast where I upload episodes 7 days a week. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. And I definitely suggest you check out the websites they came from. Sign up for the newsletters many of these sites make available, buy their books and merchandise to show your support of the creators, and some even have YouTube channels you can subscribe to for even more content. You'll never be at a loss for creepy material if you follow the source links I include in the show notes of every episode. What the Heck is a Snallygaster was written by Kathy Weiser Alexander for LegendsOfAmerica.com. Scares in the Skies is by Christopher Dale for ListVerse.com. Also from ListVerse.com is It Happened Mid-Flight by Shannon Quinn. And The Screaming Skulls was written by MJ Wayland for MJWayland.com. Again, you can find all of these links in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Psalm 91, verses 1 and 2. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. And a final thought. The goal isn't to get rid of all of your negative thoughts, feelings, and life situations. That's impossible. The goal is to change your response to them, to grow so strong on the inside that nothing on the outside can affect your well-being without you giving it permission to do so. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.